I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Iraq today, Shiites appear to be retaliating for yesterday's Sunni-led attacks on Sadr City that left more than 200 people dead. Police say militiamen attacked Sunni mosques and in one case grabbed six Sunnis as they left Friday prayers, doused them with kerosene, and burned them alive as Iraqi soldiers stood by. The fighting comes as followers of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr threaten to pull out of the government if Iraq's prime minister meets with President Bush, as scheduled, in Jordan next week. Louise Rogue is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and she joins us on the line from Baghdad. Louise, are we watching, do you think, some sort of turning point here? There doesn't seem to be much doubt left that this is a civil war.
It is indeed a civil war, and I think even by Baghdad standards, this was a horrific attack. Baghdad residents, who are already hardened by all this violence, were bracing themselves for the fallout. Yesterday, people we were talking to, Sunnis, said they really feared what would happen next, how the Shia would retaliate.
And yesterday's attack, one of yesterday's attacks, was at the Health Ministry building. Can you explain the significance of that?
Well, it was a brazen attack, certainly. First, the Health Ministry complex, which is controlled by Shia, was pummeled by mortars. Then about 30 militants, heavily armed, surrounded the ministry complex, keeping everybody hostage inside. So all the government workers, all the ministry workers, were sort of cowering inside the building as gunmen attacked the building. And according to health ministry officials, the Iraqi army soldiers nearby did not respond to calls for help. So there was a very dramatic moment when the deputy health minister went on national TV and said, you know, we've appealed for help, but we're not getting any help. We're holed up here as we're under attack, basically. Mm-hmm. Again, it appears to be a Sunni-led militants part of this whole deteriorating sectarian war here. Mm.
How significant is it that you had political leaders, Sunni, Shiite, appearing on television and appealing for calm? Does that mean anything, Louise?
At this point, the government seems so removed from the population. They live in the green zone, work out of the green zone, with very little connection, really, to the everyday life of the Iraqis on either side of the sectarian divide. So I'm not sure that the Iraqis have that much faith in their leaders anymore to provide any kind of security.
There's been criticism of U.S. forces on various fronts in the wake of this violence, some saying it proves that U.S. forces cannot provide security. What's the presence of American forces right now, and what are you hearing?
Right now, what we've seen is helicopters flying overhead and sort of keeping overwatch, but very little presence of U.S. troops on the streets. I think they're holding back, also worried about attacks against their troops. With the recent plan to clamp down on violence in the capital, they were clearly unable to prevent any of this violence. And today, despite the curfew, we've got reports of about a dozen bodies discovered in various neighborhoods. So already people being killed in assassinations and retaliation. Hmm.
Can you describe for me, I mean, what does it look like? Does it look different? Is it a lot more tense? What is it like?
I would say there's a lot more tense. Nobody was really out on the streets today. The streets were empty of vehicles as everybody stayed home. Some people went to the mosque and we heard the mosque calls out over the loudspeakers, but a very tense situation in Baghdad today.
And Louise, attached to your story that was printed today is a list of the major bombings since the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, and it's really horrible, if I can say that. Hundreds and hundreds of people killed. What are people saying about the violence? I mean, are they seeing an end to it? What's the solution, I guess?
I think people are really discouraged by this recent attack. It was exactly the kind of attack that the Americans did not want to have happen, something spectacular, something, you know, a big attack like that would just further mobilize the Shia against the Sunni and have the Sunni fear of Shia retaliation. Increasingly, the city is divided. We have, on the western side of the Tigris River, Sunni neighborhoods, and yesterday those Sunni neighborhoods were pummeled with mortars following this attack. And then, of course, we have the big Sadr City slum, which is mainly populated by Shia on the eastern side of the river.
Well, Louise, stay safe.
Thank you.
Louise Rogue is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke to us from Baghdad. Well, now we're going to shift focus to those who want to get away from the news and spend time in a virtual world. We spoke with a Massachusetts couple who admit they spend several hours each day in role-playing games online.
But I don't want to watch the news. I have enough angst. I would much rather spend my time here. This is my alternate reality, and we choose to spend our time here.
Well, what should I be doing, watching these horrible reality TV shows? This happens to be our favorite form of entertainment. I think sometimes he feels guilty.
Oh, God, I haven't used my pool in 2 years. I love to swim. And I sometimes myself, I have to be completely honest with you, I think, oh, my God, I've just spent the last 3 years of my life doing nothing.
We're not talking about video games, but virtual communities where people interact with each other online. In one online world known as Second Life, residents create avatars of themselves and spend many real hours and an estimated $60 million real dollars a year on virtual real estate, clothing, and goods. Car companies are releasing virtual versions of their new cars in Second Life. Reuters has a Second Life correspondent, and Harvard University is offering a class to Second Lifers. Well, David Weinberger is a fellow at Harvard's Law School Berkman Center for Internet and Society. And David, this community apparently is growing at a rate of about 20% a month. And let's start at the beginning here because I'm a complete novice. When I log on to Second Life, what do I find there?
When you get there, you see a 3D world you can walk around in, and the you in it is an avatar. It's a graphical representation of yourself. You get to choose and build whatever type of graphical representation of yourself you want. So you can look like a movie star. You can also look like a chicken with a dragon's head if that's somehow more appealing to you. The important part about it is that it's not a world that comes delivered to you and all set and done. It's a world that the people who use it, the residents, have built, and you can build your portion of it as well. It's an environment for building worlds and for the objects in worlds.
And what do you do then in this world? You're basically creating your fantasy person, and what are you building, really?
Well, I'm not sure that the fantasy person makes it sound as if you go in order to assume some other identity, which you're free to do. But when you're using instant messaging or technology like that, you make up a name for yourself. Mm. And that's usually some form of representation of something that's important to you. So you go in as yourself, and you can see the other avatars, the other representations of people, and can interact with them. You can talk with them. You can share the digital objects if you want. You can go to an area that's been built by a person or by an organization and do the things that they've decided that they're making available to you. So it's a very, very social environment and a highly creative one as well.
Mm-hmm. When we heard the statistics that we mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, about $60 million maybe being spent this year. Can you explain where the commerce comes into all of this?
There are a couple of places. Mm-hmm. And it is, the commerce has been what the business press in particular has grabbed upon, because it's something tangible. I mean, it has a GDP of $64 million. I mean, that's pretty phenomenal. But it would be a mistake to think that this is primarily a commercial environment. It's primarily a social and creative environment. Nevertheless, there's real money being spent there. So everybody who goes gets a certain amount of pocket money. The money is in Linden dollars because Linden Labs is the group that created it. But there's a real-life exchange, a currency exchange that works the way a real currency exchange does, that converts Linden dollars into U.S. dollars.
Why is it becoming so popular, do you think? What exactly does it do for people?
Because it's a platform. It's a place where people or groups can build stuff. It's like saying, why are people reading things? Well, they're reading things because people are writing interesting things. So there's lots and lots of activity. There are buildings being built and islands being created by all sorts of groups. And some of them are individuals or nonprofits, and some of them are well-known household brands that are doing some marketing there. People go for a wide variety of reasons. There's a very interesting intersection, I think, of First Life, the real world, with Second Life, so that there have been a variety of events that are occurring in the real world that get channeled into Second Life. One of the examples is, in fact, a class at Harvard. It's held in a real classroom at Harvard, and it's an actual class. But anybody who wants to go to this class can attend through Second Life. They go to the island. The graphics and the sound of the class in real time is brought into you can watch it on a screen within Second Life with other people who are represented as avatars there, mm-hmm. and you can talk with them about what the class is discussing. That's a pretty interesting intersection of First and Second Life.
Oh. David, stay with us for just 1 second, because right now I want to bring in John Lester. He works in the Community Development Group for Linden Labs. So your avatar, your online name is Pathfinder Linden.
Yes.
Can you explain just how does Linden Lab make money in Second Life?
Well, fundamentally, what we do is we provide a platform within which the users, which we call residents, can create whatever they want. So, in a sense, we're kind of like an internet service provider providing something like web hosting. With Second Life, if you want to create a permanent 3D space, say like have an island, you basically buy land from us and pay us a monthly fee for hosting that physical space.
Who would you say is a typical Second Life resident?
Oh, it's like saying who's a typical person in the world. I would say the typical Second Life resident is someone who uses Second Life to augment their real life. So, say for instance, someone has a job and a career and is happy and has a family and so forth. Yet there's something that they want to do more. You know, they've always wanted to maybe try their hand at perhaps playing live music. That's actually one thing that's a big thing in Second Life. You have live musicians performing in Second Life in little concert venues and performing at clubs. Somebody who has a dream that is difficult to realize in the physical world. And you know, in the physical world, we're bounded by the laws of the physical world. For instance, you're in a physical space that you're living in, and maybe there aren't any people in your own physical neighborhood who are interested in the same kinds of things you're interested in. So, I would say the typical Second Life resident is somebody who uses Second Life to make their real life more fulfilling.
That's John Lester with Linden Lab, the creator of the virtual community known as Second Life. We're also talking with David Weinberger, a fellow at Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. When we come back, we hear from a Second Life resident who says the hours he spends each day on Second Life aren't about augmenting his first life, but providing a creative outlet for social change. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation about the virtual world known as Second Life.
Life beyond reality. Where imagination knows no bounds. And the world is anything but ordinary.
That was a clip from the winning submission to the Best Second Life Video 2006, perhaps illustrating just how far-reaching this virtual world has become. More than 1 million people are residents of Second Life, and they're spending millions of dollars there. Joining us to talk about this is David Weinberger of Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society. Also with us is Gary Goldberger, who is the Second Life ambassador for the group Games for Change, which creates video games for social change. Just try to get your head around that one for a moment. And Gary, before the break, John Lester of Linden Lab, the creator of Second Life, said the typical Second Lifer is looking to augment real life with this virtual reality. So why do you think that you spend a great deal of time in Second Life?
I guess I have a different perspective. I don't really think that people are going to fulfill a different part of their lives. I think that a lot of people are being brought in by friends in the real world. So I know a lot of people that are like, oh, yeah, this is my friend that lives down the street, and we kind of came on together to play. But not, you know, like that there's a deficit in people's lives and that this is fulfilling that deficit. Mm-hmm. That's not really how I see the world. Mm-hmm. I see it as a place where you can do things that potentially you can't do in the real world, but I don't think that it's kind of like this emotional void that it's filling.
You are Gary, as I've just introduced you, in this life, but in Second Life, you are who?
I am Garrick Gordimer. I am the ambassador for Games for Change in Second Life.
Can you explain why and what that
what
means?
What that is, what exactly that is? Games for Change is not-for-profit. What we do is we provide support and visibility and shared resources for individuals and organizations that are using digital games for social change. Okay. So when we're playing, we actually call it in-world.
Okay.
So you're in the world of Second Life. I basically educate people about what our mission is, get people interested in our initiative, and potentially, you know, to get involved, to join our group, and then start real-world kind of conversations.
And how much time would you say you spend on average in Second Life?
When I get into world, it's usually between 2 and 3 hours a night.
And do you find that people are receptive to this? If they're in Second Life, do they want to sort of start thinking about social change and all this heavy stuff?
It sounds very heavy, doesn't it? But the thing is we're working on it towards through the media of video games. And I think that's a different platform than if I was coming and, I guess, talking about a more, you know, less technology-based initiative. Yeah, people go online basically leisure time. You know, I want to go hang out and talk to friends. I want to go to a casino and gamble. But there's also a bunch of initiatives that are happening that are more educational-based and more community practice-based. And you kind of find the people that are interested in different islands and different worlds. Mm-hmm. So
obviously, there are a lot of skeptics and who might say, you know, why not use this creativity and use this outlet in real things, in real life, instead of online?
It is a dilemma. There's a lot of time spent on the virtual world. But we feel, and our stance is that technology is either going to be the problem or part of the solution. And we're taking the stance that it's going to be part of the solution.
We're going back now to David Weinberger, who's a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. And David, I'm just wondering, can you tell me, what do you think about the skeptics who say that the folks who spend a lot of time and a lot of creative energy in Second Life, why not, or wouldn't it be a better use of their creative energy and time to be doing that in real life as opposed to Second Life?
So tell me how in the real world, where we're supposed to be not wasting our time, how we can find a set of people from around the world, get together and talk about what's interesting to us for as long as it's interesting to us, and then find a different set from anywhere in the world. It's an environment in which we can do what we as human beings want to do. And in some cases, it's to sell sneakers, but in other cases, it's to advance social causes. In other cases, it's to create works of art, to make them available to anybody in the world who wants to see them. Second Life is a very creative social environment. So the criticism that it's not as good as the real world, well, yeah, it's different than the real world, but in some ways it's better.
When we talk about the business aspect of what's happening in Second Life and we hear that Toyota is releasing a car in Second Life and businesses are very interested in what's happening there. Can you explain that a little bit, how that works and why?
It's a good demographic. So it's a cool place to be. So there are lots of businesses that are, and it's relatively cheap to set up shop there. So there are lots of businesses who are there trying stuff out, seeing what it's like, getting their feet wet. Why not? There are also lots of entrepreneurs who are not well-known businesses like Disney and IBM and Intel and Toyota and Adidas who are all there. There are also some companies that are using it in a different way. So Leo Burnett has a worldwide distributed staff, and they use it as a way of holding virtual meetings, bringing people together, which is an entirely different business use of it, but why not?
But there are a lot of critics who have said that because we're in front of screens so much and because we are in sometimes this other world that isn't real, what does that do to a community and people's sense of community? Does it isolate people?
You mean the vibrant U.S. communities where we all go out every evening, we spend hours and hours on the sidewalks talking with our friends, engaged in deep conversation, that community that doesn't exist?
Right.
That's the fantasy. So this is an environment we've made for ourselves that is intensely social. It's differently social, mm-hmm. but it's if there were no other people there, this is not a video game. This is not a Dungeons and Dragons video game where you go in and you slash and cut, fun as those are, but there's no other real people there. This is entirely populated by people projecting themselves and their interests and their passions and their senses of humor and creativity into a territory that we get to build together.
David Weinberger is a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. We also spoke with Gary Goldberger, ambassador for Games for Change in Second Life. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Cell phones that play movies, MP3 players that connect to your TiVo, and video game controllers that move characters based on your movements. These are just some examples of the latest technology and the added features to technology. And in an effort to acknowledge Black Friday, one of the busiest shopping days of the year today, we're looking at high tech with Wired Magazine's best gadgets and gizmos on the planet. The editors rated hundreds of products on a scale of complete failure in every way to metaphysical product perfection for their special Wired Test Edition. And products editor Mark McCluskey joins us with more. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, you got to play with a lot of these gadgets. Was there any sort of theme or trend that you noticed in terms of what these new products are striving for?
Yeah, one of the trends we've really seen this year is that a lot of these gadgets are trying to sort of not only connect with one another, but also connect online so that you have, you know, cameras with internet access built in so you can download your pictures wirelessly to your PC, or you have a cell phone that also connects online and lets you take pictures and email them to people and send text messages and check your email as well as making phone calls. So that's been a big thing we've seen this year.
Let's start with cell phones. Sure. You rate the Motorola Q.
That was our best of test. Out of all the phones we tested, it was our top choice. The Q you can sort of think of as kind of the offspring of, you know, the Motorola Razr, the very thin sort of stylish phone, and then the BlackBerry, which is sort of oriented around checking email but is a little bit bigger. The Q sort of bridges that gap. It's both thin and stylish, but also has a great keyboard, so it's great for sort of dealing with email or text messaging or web browsing.
But it weighs 4 ounces?
It's just 4 ounces, and even more importantly, it's very thin.
But you can watch videos on it.
You can watch videos. It runs a Windows-based operating system, so if you have downloaded some videos online, you can convert those to a format that will play. It's got a beautiful high-resolution screen, and the videos actually look terrific on it.
They also go into computers, laptop, yes, the Apple MacBook Pro. That one was best of test, and that's, what, $2,500, right?
It is $2,500. You know, unfortunately, laptops are pretty expensive just because miniaturizing all the parts really takes a lot of effort. What's unique about the MacBook is it's the first machine out there that will let you run either the Macintosh operating system or Windows. Like me, I use a Mac at work, but there are some Windows things that would be nice to run. It's a system that I can sort of do both of those things with.
When you made these ratings or you devised these ratings, did you also look at how complicated it is? Because to do all of these things, to have a cell phone that weighs 4 ounces and is a combination BlackBerry that plays movies at the same time, that completely seems overwhelming to me. I'm a person who can't seem to change the ringer on my phone. My kids have this annoying ringer on my phone. I'm going to let you listen to it, right?
Okay.
This is my cell phone. I can't make it stop doing this Christmas carol. So do you, when you make these ratings, are you thinking of people like me who don't know how to change the ring on the cell phone?
You know, we definitely do try and take usability into account. You know, it's the best product in the world. If nobody can figure out how to deal with it, you know, it doesn't matter what it can do if it just sort of sits there and your kids sabotage it all the time and force Christmas carols to be your constant companion throughout the year. So we definitely do think about that. Amazing technology will let us overlook some of those shortcomings, but we do try and keep that focus on the fact that it can't just be cool and innovative, but it has to be usable as well.
Mm-hmm. And price as well, when we're talking $2,500 laptop.
Absolutely. You know, price in a vacuum is sort of hard to evaluate. $2,500 seems like a lot of money, but you have to sort of look at those prices in the context of all the other products that it's lined up against.
You do have an under $50 category, we should say, right?
There are some great little widgets that, you know, if you're looking for sort of more tech stocking stuffers, we really love. Nike makes something in conjunction with Apple that is a small transmitter that goes inside of your running shoes. And then there's a receiver that you hook up to your iPod. And what it does is it actually records sort of how far you've run, how fast you're running, all of this data right onto your iPod, which is pretty slick. And it's just $29, that little receiver.
This issue of the magazine also talks about a new MP3 player that you say will give the iPod a run for its money.
We actually liked it better than the iPod, which is saying something given iPod's total domination of this market. It's the Toshiba Gigabeat S is the name of the player. It's beautiful. It's easy to use. It's lighter than the iPod and has a better screen than the iPod, which as more and more people start watching video on these MP3 players, Apple has done a lot with that and Microsoft is following suit. That great screen really, really helps the video look terrific as you're, you know, on your commute or on a plane or something like that.
No iTunes, though, I presume.
No iTunes, yeah. Mm. That is the downside. What it does do is it works with things like Rhapsody, where you can actually subscribe and you sort of can download as much music as you want every month for an ongoing subscription fee instead of buying songs a la carte on iTunes. And this Toshiba player works tremendously well with the Rhapsody service.
How about gaming consoles?
The one that we're actually most excited about is sort of different. It's the Nintendo Wii, which is spelled, strangely, W-I-I. The Wii actually comes out this holiday as well. It's got this motion controller. So the controller actually looks like a remote, like a TV remote. But if you're playing, say, a baseball game and you hold the remote like a baseball bat and swing it, your character on screen swings his bat when you do. It sort of knows where the controller is in space, and that's how you interact with the games. It's a really cool, interesting way to think about that.
And how much does that go for?
It's going to be $250. And the other great thing sort of for people like me who love old video games, sort of the classic games, there's going to be a service where you can download some of Nintendo's greatest hits from the past, some of the old Mario games and some of the Donkey Kong and Zelda and old arcade and console games. You'll be able to download right onto this console and play them at home.
And $250 is fairly a bargain for a game console right now.
It's a huge bargain compared to the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3. You know, the PlayStation 3 is either $500 or $600, and the Xbox 360 is $300 or $400.
And speaking of prices, I saw a remote control for $400.
There is a remote control that goes for $400 from Logitech, yes.
Why?
It depends on your needs. If you have just a TV and maybe a cable box, you know, $400 for a remote probably isn't anything you would ever spend your money on. But if you're someone who starts to get a TiVo and then a stereo receiver and then a couple of video game consoles and a surround sound receiver and you start to get 6, 7, 8 remotes on your coffee table, I actually counted the other day, I have 8 on my coffee table. Much to my wife's chagrin. Then all of a sudden spending $400 for a remote that you can program to do all of those jobs actually makes a little bit of sense. A nice thing to have.
So that's what you want for the holidays. You want the $400.
Exactly. I think that's what my wife wants for me.
Okay. Well, Mark McCluskey, gadgets guru at Wired Magazine, talking with us about the special Wired Test Edition that reviewed more than 300 products. Don't know if I'm going to be able to get any of these because I'm still struggling with the cell phone. Mark, thanks very much for speaking with us.
No, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Isn't that horrible? You're listening to Here and Now.
K4 service number 372. 10-4, sir. Thank you. I'll be back in service. Sir, I'm with an occupant.
Many of us are probably familiar with police language known as the 10 codes from popular music and movies like Smokey and the Bandit. It's been around since the 1920s, but this month, the Virginia State Police abandoned the 10 codes and ordered their officers to use common language, in other words, plain English. Since the adoption of the 10 codes, police departments across the country have developed their own versions of them. For instance, in the Washington, D.C. area, airport security 1054 means lost property, but to the Virginia State Police, 1054 means livestock on the highway. And after 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina, these inconsistencies created problems. Joining us to talk about this is Lieutenant Colonel H.C. Davis from the Virginia State Police. Hello there, Lieutenant Colonel.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, well, can you explain exactly what's happening in the Virginia State Police? Are officers no longer allowed to use the 10 codes when they speak?
As of November the 1st, we have stopped using 10 codes throughout our radio traffic. We know old habits die hard. It'll probably take a few months for the troopers out in the road to abandon them all together.
Mm-hmm. And why did you decide to do that? Is there a particular example of a time when the language was just so confusing you said, look, we've got to get rid of this?
Yes, it started several years ago. The most acute aspect, I guess, was probably last fall after Hurricane Katrina. We sent a contingent of troopers to Mississippi for 2 week stints between September and December to help out. It became readily apparent to us when we got there that their 10 codes are entirely different from ours. So we had to go to a common language so we could communicate. Also, the Department of Homeland Security has suggested over the last several years that most agencies should go to a common language during everyday traffic on the radios. So when an emergency or disaster occurs, when you do have to work amongst agencies, it won't be such a change to go to a common language.
Can you give me an example of what might have happened when your officers went down to help with Hurricane Katrina? Was there a particular 10 code that you said, oh my gosh, this is a real problem?
Well, you know, actually down there in Mississippi, every 10 code they had was different than ours. So, I mean, you could go down the list and pick anything. Now, one that really comes to mind in Virginia that we've had here, we have other agencies that sometimes are on the radio system, and some are alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, a federal agency. We had one that was using our frequencies in Virginia. They were in Maryland at the time and came upon a car accident on one of the on the beltway there. They called it into Maryland State Police as a 1050, which is a car accident in Virginia, and then got out of the vehicle and started to assist the drivers in the accident. Well, in Maryland, a 1050 is officer down, needs help. Entirely different meaning there. So imagine his surprise when four or five officers come rolling up to the scene. Luckily, no one was hurt, and, you know, it's sort of humorous, but it could have been dangerous,
right,
the situation there.
Right, right. What happens if something is confidential or you don't want to ruin a chase or something like that, and you have to communicate that information over the radio? How do you do it without the 10 codes?
Basically, that's when we use one of our signals, and I'll tell you, one of the signals is signal 4, and that means that it's some confidential information is coming. That way, the trooper on the road will know that dispatcher has some type of information that may be sensitive that he may not want to discuss over the air in common language, and then they can either think of some other means of communication like a telephone or something like that to get that information to him. Or if they have someone in the car that they've ran a wanted check on, and they come back that they are wanted, they will give them that signal so they'll be sure that they have that person under control before they call them and tell them what it is they're wanted for.
You know, it seems like it was such a part of police culture almost to have this language, and you had to be a member to actually use it. Do you think that it's sort of a loss in police culture in a way?
Well, I've been on the state police for 30 years, and it is a tradition. It is something that's hard to give up, but I think looking at it in the long run, and in Virginia we have some projects going for interoperability amongst agencies with radio systems, and it just stands to reason that we all ought to be talking the same language.
All right. Well, Lieutenant Colonel H.C. Davis from the Virginia State Police, thanks very much for speaking
right
with us.
Thank you.
This is Trooper Baker. I'm heading for the fairgrounds.
Well, I'm going on a 10-9. That's a coffee break, good buddy. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. It's a scene that most parents of young children recognize, being trapped in the car with kids asking to hear the same perky, repetitive song over and over again. By the time the parents have heard, oh, the 73rd refrain of Barney's I Love You song, they might be wondering if earphones for toddlers are really such a bad thing after all. Well, we have an alternative to the purple dinosaur.
They came over to play on my swing set. Her dinosaur just smashed it flat. I threw him a ball to fetch. He came back with my dad's car in his mouth. Oh, oh, oh.
Indie rocker Ralph Covert is making kids' music that adults may want to play over and over again. He used to play with the band The Bad Examples, primarily in smoky clubs until 3 in the morning. Now he wraps things up by nap time. His new CD-DVD is called Welcome to Ralph's World, and Ralph Covert is here to tell us more. Welcome.
Deborah, thank you.
Well, we said you used to play with the Bad Examples, and you used to sing about drinking till you drop, and now you're singing about the dinosaur rumble. Why did you decide to make this transition?
Well, it was it kind of happened accidentally, really. It was kind of fun. The Bad Examples had been touring a little bit less. My daughter, Fiona, had just been born, and I'd been teaching a songwriting class at a place in Chicago called the Old Town School of Folk Music. And I think they recognized that they had me at a moment of weakness with a new child, and they've got a program there called the Wiggle Worms that's like, you know, singing songs for little kids and their moms. And they said, listen, just bring your daughter, do whatever you want, sing, rock, be as loud and crazy as you want. And I did it, and I just found myself having so much fun hanging with the parents and making music for the kids and the parents. And all these years later, I find myself still having just as much fun, but actually having it be the mainstay of my career right now.
So were you at the time thinking that there was something missing from kids' music? Was it Puff the Magic Dragon wasn't happening here, and so you were deciding to do something different consciously, or how would you describe it?
Well, I wasn't really thinking of it in terms of, okay, now I'm going to make kids' music. I was just sharing music with people that are 3 and 33 and enjoying it.
Right. You've got a little bit of something in there for the kids and, you know, a little bit of something for parents. I'm thinking of the coffee song on your CD, which, you know, obviously has parents spelling out words that maybe the kids don't need to know, although you didn't spell vino, but, you know, you spelled that. let's listen to a little bit of that right now.
O-M-M-Y-N-E-C-O-F-F-E-E-D-A-D-D-Y need C-O-F-F-E-E. I want a latte, a cappuccino, and tonight I think I'll have a little vino.
Is there something that universally appeals to you to be able to not only bridge the 3 and 33-year-old, but also make the switch from Bad Example to Ralph's World? I mean, is there something, maybe being an eternal optimist, does that come through in both cases, or what is it?
I just think a powerful belief and just how wonderful it is to be alive. I remember when I was a kid, you know, there was just that sense of wonder and that sense of the texture of what it was like to feel things and explore things. And, you know, I guess what I try to do when I write to kids is honor them as full people that are earlier on in the process of finding the world.
There you go. There's such a variety on the Ralph's World CD, too. There's a little rock, some reggae, some polka. So yep. You've got a little bit of everything. But you also, on the CD, you go into a very tender ballad about growing up. Riding with no hands. Right, right.
Yeah.
So let's listen to a little bit of that.
Oh, I love that song.
My mother is a little bit taller than me. But who knows how long it will be like that, 'cause things are changing. I get a little taller every day. My father is a little bit smarter than me, but who knows how much longer things will be like that, 'cause things are changing, and I've been changing. I get a little smarter every day.
I'll tell you a funny thing that you'll hear on the very last couple lines of the song. It says, Beauregard is my very first dog. You know, it's kind of a throwaway line. It's kind of almost a non sequitur type line. And you can hear in my voice, when we did this song in the studio, the vocal performance is first take. It's, you know, I walked in the booth, sang it, boom. Every time I tried to sing that last line, my voice choked. I'm choking up here remembering it. My voice choked up, and I started to cry. And we finally got it. And the problem was, because my throat tightened, it would throw me out of pitch.
Oh, my gosh.
So we had to do that last line again and again, because every time I tried to sing it, just the emotion of remembering, you know, all the emotions that are in the song would trip me up. So we finally got one that was good. But even the final line of it, you can hear my throat tighten and the tone gets a little tighter. So as we're talking about the emotional experience of being a kid, I think this song just for me was kind of it's almost like that little kid voice kind of popped out and said, hey, you know, remember.
Hodeo, over the rainbow, hidey high, to the top of the sky, Beauregard was my very first dog. And I'm riding with no hands. I'm riding with no hands. I'm still riding with no hands.
Do you find that creatively that this is working for you, or do you think you might go back and do some more bad example songs, or what's next?
Oh, I'm absolutely doing bad example stuff. We're working on a new record. I've got some new Bad Examples songs that I'm just absolutely thrilled with. I look at kids' music as one facet of what I do as an artist, as a human being, just as a parent. I mean, there's things you do with your kids that are you as a fully invested person being a parent with your kids, and there's things that you might do with your spouse that you do fully invested as a person experiencing that part of who you are. So for me, as an artist, as a person, there's this whole range of things that I have the privilege of being able to pursue and challenge myself to create in, a whole range of ways to express that.
Well, thanks very much for helping us all remember what it's like to be a kid.
Oh, well, thanks so much for your interest, and it was a real delight talking to you about stuff.
That's Ralph Covert. His CD-DVD, Welcome to Ralph's World, is in stores now. For more, visit our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Have a great weekend and join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.